So when we think about this goal of healthiest nation in one generation, those of you who are evidence-based and data-driven, we need to figure out what our baseline is. Where are we starting from? And my job in this presentation series is to give you the data on where we are right now, which is not the healthiest nation. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to cover a lot of that information. It's going to be depressing. So as a physician, I feel the need for informed consent before we go forward. I jokingly sometimes say that I need to hand out antidepressants before I give this talk. I also have to apologize for talking fast because we're trying to make the maximum use of time. I have nothing to disclose. So let me begin with where the American public's thinking is on this. When we think about how we're doing in terms of our health, there is a sense that we have the best healthcare system in the world. We have cutting-edge technology. We have the Mayo Clinic and lots of biomedical research advances that few other countries can rival. Americans tend to think of the fact that even if they accept the notion that there are some deficiencies in their healthcare system, that's certainly been something made more visible with the recent healthcare reform debates, that their health is still the best in the world. And that turns out not to be the case. This is a graph, like many I'm sure you've seen before, plotting how much we spend on healthcare in the various countries around the world on the horizontal axis and life expectancy on the vertical axis. And this country that's way over here on the right, I don't know if this cursor is working. I'm just doing it too fast. Here we are. So we're you know, this is typically shown to point out that we spend a lot of money on healthcare and don't get our money's worth. But the important thing I want you to focus on is the vertical axis, which is that those other countries that are spending less on healthcare are also living longer. They have a longer life expectancy. And that was really the focus of a report by a panel that I had the opportunity to chair that was sponsored by the National Research Council and the Institute of Medicine. And that's what I'm going to be racing through. It's a 400-page report. I'm going to race through it in a few minutes, just some of the key data, just to give that as a foundation for the conversations we're going to have in the next as the session unfolds. But if you want to read more about it, the URL is down there, or you can just Google shorter lives, poor health. So what we did, this was a report that was released in 2013, is we compared the U.S. with the 16 other so-called peer countries, other large economies, large democracies that we thought were closest in comparison to the U.S. And just to give you a big picture view, if you think about mortality rates in three buckets, non-communicable diseases, communicable diseases, and injuries, and the red bar is the United States, the gray bars are the other countries, what you see is for non-communicable diseases, we have the second highest mortality rate, for communicable diseases, the fourth highest, and for certain communicable diseases like HIV, the highest, and mortality from injuries, second highest after Finland. But then when you drill down and look at the actual specific causes of death, this table is showing the very diverse list of conditions that for which we have higher mortality rates than the other countries. So this list here are the causes of death where our mortality rates are higher than the OECD average, and this shorter list at the bottom are the ones where we're average or better. So first thing you see right away is this list is longer, but if you pay closer attention to the diversity here of conditions and think about the pathophysiology of these conditions, you realize very, very different health problems, and across all of those there is a health disadvantage for the U.S. Our life expectancy numbers, Sonia referred to this earlier, bottom for male life expectancy, second from the bottom in terms of female life expectancy. A lot of people know this already, but what was news to us was the temporal trends over time. So what this is showing you, the red dots is the United States, the gray dots are the peer countries, and this is starting back in 1980. And what you can see is how we have gradually fallen to the bottom of the ranking over that time. Same for females. So this is a long-standing pattern that we're dealing with, this health disadvantage, not a statistical fluke for one particular year. And this is the slide I often comment on as the most disturbing. This is the probability of surviving to age 50. For males, again, somewhere within in the middle of the range, sort of, in the 1980s, and then falling off to the bottom ranking by current period. But look at females. The probability of a woman surviving to age 50 is lowest if it's an American woman, something that most American women probably aren't aware of. We tried to look at this by age group to try to understand what diseases were driving this health disadvantage, and what you can see is that for every age group, all the way up to age 75, the U.S. ranking is at the bottom or second from the bottom. The good news is if you make it to age 75, you're in better shape in the United States than in other countries, clearly this is a pervasive problem that affects babies, it affects young children, it affects adolescents, young adults, seniors, and so forth. So one of the things we were conscious of as we were working on this was that people would push back and say, well, you're comparing the United States to Sweden or Finland, and these are not comparable countries. Those are smaller countries or have more homogeneous populations. The United States has a lot of racial and ethnic diversity. We have a lot of poverty. It's well known that there's a prominent health disadvantage for vulnerable populations and so forth. So maybe what you're seeing here is our average is being drawn down by those folks. And so what we did was we analyzed the data for certain subgroups, in this case non-Hispanic whites, and you see, just to back it up, basically the same pattern for non-Hispanic whites. And in other analyses that I don't have time to go through, we looked at college-educated Americans, insured Americans, Americans who are not obese, who don't smoke. The health disadvantage was pervasive across all those groups. Rich Americans die earlier than rich people in other countries. This is a systemic issue that's not, it's obviously worse for vulnerable populations and disadvantaged groups, but not restricted to them. Across a number of different metrics that we looked at, that I'm going to rush through right now, we found a recurrent pattern. This is the probability of dying in a car crash in the United States, less than the OECD average. Mortality from violent injuries, no surprise to this audience that we are way in a different league than the others in terms of our probability of dying from violent injuries and from homicide for firearm-related violence as well. Obesity, it won't surprise you that we have the highest obesity rates in the industrialized world, but look at the age group. So even down to age 15 to 24, 25 to 34, the United States leads in terms of obesity rates. Also not surprisingly, given the connections between obesity and diabetes, we have very high prevalence rates for diabetes. If you start looking at the life course, beginning with infancy, our numbers do not look good compared to other countries. I told you this would be depressing. This is infant mortality rates, and this is a graph that I think is poignant in showing how long this has been the case. So the lines crossed decades ago, where infant mortality rates in the U.S. Could not keep pace with progress being made in other countries. Other examples of infant mortality, and again, looking at specific groups like non-Hispanic whites and mothers with more than 16 years of education, we still see a health disadvantage in the U.S. Other birth outcomes, such as low birth weight, the United States, again, very high prevalence rates. This analysis came out during our panel's deliberations, an analysis of 184 countries showing our preterm birth rate comparable to sub-Saharan Africa. If you move on from infancy, because you know that problem with infant mortality is something that we know about pretty well in the public health community, people probably don't realize that the health disadvantage continues on. So for the age group 0 to 5, the probability of a child surviving to age 5 is lowest if it's an American child. Our mortality rates are that high. And across a number of other metrics of child wellness, negligence, maltreatment, assault, and so forth, the U.S. tends to score poorly. OECD and UNICEF rankings consistently have given the United States poor marks for child well-being. Adolescents, mortality rates, obesity rates, higher among American teens than among teens in other countries. It's not limited to mortality data. It also applies to diseases and morbidity, the highest teen pregnancy rates, the highest rates of STDs, HIV infection, adolescent injury mortality, and again, this is not a new phenomenon. It goes back to the 1950s that the probability of teens dying from injuries has been higher in the United States than in other countries. From violence, again, won't surprise this group. The only good news here is this peak is over with, but we're still like in a totally different world than the other industrialized countries in terms of violent injury rates. By the time you get to age 50 and above, there is a long laundry list of chronic diseases. There's a large literature on this. You can see some of the articles in the background. I've made this cheat sheet for you, basically showing all the different conditions where studies have shown that the prevalence rates for those conditions are higher among Americans over age 50 than among people in other countries. Any good news? Well, here it is. Our cancer mortality rates tend to be lower in the United States than in the other countries, primarily for cancers where we've been very aggressive around early detection. The evidence is sort of mixed about whether stroke mortality is a little better in the U.S. Than in other countries. We're definitely better at controlling blood pressure and lipids. We got that covered. But our cardiovascular mortality rates are not better. So it just means that we're really aggressive with the meds in terms of controlling those values. Suicide, about average compared to other countries. I mentioned earlier that if you make it to old age, your life expectancy is higher in the U.S. than in other countries. And then the ironic one is if you survey people and ask them to rate their health, Americans are more likely to report their health as fair or excellent, as good or excellent. In terms of causes, so we try to take all of this information and put it into some buckets of what are the different conditions that seem to be where we are having these health disadvantages and place them into these nine categories. And one of the things that jumps out at you when you look at this, if imagine yourself on our panel trying to come up with an explanation, those of you who are physicians or nurses, you were taught that you're supposed to look for a unifying diagnosis. And there is no single explanation that could account for all of these different problems. It's not like you could say, well, it's smoking or it's obesity or it's guns. These conditions are too diverse to lend themselves to a simple explanation. We did take a socio-ecological approach. In our report, we looked at all the different things that affect health outcomes. So we have a chapter that looks at healthcare and public health systems. We looked at individual behaviors like physical activity and smoking and so forth. We looked at socioeconomic conditions, the physical and social environment, public policies and social values, which shape all of those. And in each of those categories, we asked, how are we different in the U.S. than in those other countries that might explain what's going on here? And unfortunately, if you read those chapters, you'll find in every single one of them bad news, again, about how we compare in terms of the other countries. Health systems, for example, how our healthcare system differs from the other countries, you know, jumps right out. We don't have universal health insurance coverage like all those other countries do. We have a weak primary care workforce, poor coordination of care, lack of electronic medical records, public health systems infrastructure, as this audience knows, is not as organized as it is in those other countries. Individual behaviors, we looked at caloric intake. We have more per capita caloric intake in the United States than in any other country in the world. Injurious behaviors, American motorists are less likely to fasten their seatbelt, motorcyclists less likely to wear their helmets, gun ownership, completely different civilian firearm ownership in the United States at much higher rates than in other countries. Socioeconomic conditions, income inequality, child poverty rates, that's what this bar chart showing on the left. We have the highest child poverty rates, and we've had them since the 1980s. We've been leading the industrialized world in our child poverty rate. In terms of education, the major social determinant of health, comparing how much we invest in education in the United States and how well our kids are doing in terms of educational outcomes. Again, we lag behind other countries. When we looked at public policies, I told you I'd be speaking fast, so I apologize. We found a pattern where less investment in social services and social programs and safety net programs than exist in those other countries. So, take a breath. The caption says, my question is, are we making an impact? So how do we change this? So they've identified this goal here of making us the healthiest nation in the world. And if we keep doing what we're doing now, it's pretty clear that's not going to work. You can see from the chart I showed you earlier which way this line is going. So unless there's bold transformative change, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out where these curves are headed. So I do want to take a bit of a digression to talk about this goal and to draw attention to another IOM report. I happened to serve on this committee a couple years before the one I just mentioned that was making recommendations about the future of the public's health. And we took up this question of what is a reason, because we already were conscious in that report that the U.S. Numbers did not look good compared to other countries, what is a reasonable target that we can set for ourselves? And we shied away from this ambitious goal of saying that the U.S. should be the healthiest nation in the world. our committee, when we deliberated on it, felt like that it would be ambitious enough to try to be average, to try to set a goal of having an average OECD life expectancy and cost of care. And that's something we can talk about during the Q&A, what's a realistic target? Because a lot would have to change to get us even to average, never mind to be the best. But setting our sights high is probably a good thing. I was asked to comment, because I'm the data guy in this panel, so I was asked to talk about what kind of data we would need to look at to, if APHA or other groups that are involved with this initiative were to track how well we are doing in reaching this target. And part of my closing message in my last minutes here is to say that there are a lot of data sources that we can potentially turn to try to track this. Shown here are the kinds of data that our panel looked at, that looked at the U.S. health disadvantage, and these are the variables where we found information that we could compare across countries. But if we're talking about domestic analysis in the United States, there obviously is a richer set of data that we can potentially examine. We are at our center where I work, a Center on Society and Health, in the midst of a study right now funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where we're comparing the health of the states. So this is a domestic analysis like the one you just saw, where we're looking at how health varies across the states and trying to look into those same domains that I mentioned earlier to try to understand, well, what's going on within each of the states that's explaining these differences in health status. And we're taking a really deep dive into the potential data sources available. So this overwhelming list here is just, this is not the variables, this is simply the data sources that we're going to. And in this column, you can see the number of variables that we're downloading. Derek Chapman over here in the audience has got the lovely job of downloading all that data. It's an overwhelming task. But the point is that there is this potential for us to get very granular in looking at the data sources. I do want to say that most of us in public health know that it's not a state-level issue. If you really want to make a difference in sort of moving the needle on population health, it's at the local level, at the community level, that change really happens. This is a map that we produced for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation of New Orleans, and we're doing maps like these around the country. These are conversation starters to help sort of draw attention to how life expectancy variations occur, not just between the United States and other countries, and not just between states, but across neighborhoods. And in fact, some of those differences across neighborhoods are much more dramatic than the differences between countries or between states. As you can see in this example from New Orleans, where there's a 25-year difference in life expectancy. And then it sort of begs the question of what's going on there that's responsible for that. This is a report we did for New Orleans a few years ago, this is, you know, a 50-page report that sort of digs through the potential factors going on in the neighborhoods of New Orleans that might be contributing to some of these health differences. And that's where I think the opportunity lies for change. I think the bold transformative change that we're going to need if we're going to achieve a goal like this is the kind of unified effort that people talk about now in terms of collective impact. And I've already heard at this APHA meeting so many references to this new movement of trying to work together at the community level, where stakeholders from different groups all chip in and bring their respective talents to the table. One of my favorite examples of this is the one in San Diego, Live Well San Diego, where 50 or 60 partner organizations are all working together toward a common goal of trying to improve population health. Maybe during the Q&A we can talk more about the promise of collective impact. But to leave time for my other fellow speakers, I'll stop now. Thank you.